Today at Reader's Corner, David Ignatius, author of the new thriller, Phantom Orbit. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Our guest today is David Ignatius, speaking with us about his latest thriller, Phantom Orbit. I'm always on the lookout for novels that spin great yarns, but also inform and teach us something about the world around us. Phantom Orbit does just that, going beyond our world and into space to alert us to a new and different kind of competition in great power rivalry. David Ignatius is a prize-winning columnist and associate editor for The Washington Post and has been covering the Middle East and the CIA for nearly four decades. He has written 11 novels that allow him to expand on his columns and address issues of national security. You may have seen him on MSNBC as a guest of the Morning Joe show. David Ignatius, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Nice to be with you, Bob.
Well, David, you are well known for novels that peek around the corner, and they address issues that maybe a good number of folks haven't seen yet. Sometimes present-day challenges, other times not. Tell us about how you landed in space with Phantom Orbit.
Well, I landed in space because in my journalism, I write a column twice a week for the Washington Post. There was a big debate developing in 2018, 2019 about whether to create a space force to take over responsibility for this domain of potential military conflict. And the Pentagon reaction, the reaction of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was no, not a good idea. This was something President Trump was pushing, and there was a lot of resistance. And I began looking into it, and the more I looked, the more it seemed to me that it actually made sense to have a separate service for space, that the Air Force, which had responsibility for decades, had really not done as aggressive a job as it should as China and Russia began developing space weapons. It stands to reason that the Air Force is run by, has always been run by fighter pilots, basically, sure. And space is not their first concern. So I ended up writing columns saying that the creating the Space Force made sense, talked to the first commander of it, General J. Raymond. And so the idea just really began to captivate me. I did more and more research. And then, as happened to me often in my work, I found a subject that was so intriguing in journalism that I wanted to give it more space, let it be as complicated and interesting as it was in reality. So I began thinking about how I could craft a novel that would have space in the background and characters to carry the story forward. But that's basically how it happened. I was writing about something, it intrigued me, and then luckily I had this other outlet of fiction to expand it.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a great one. I so much enjoy your novels, but this one I felt like I was getting a lesson in space as well. This also coincides, you might say, with a trip you made to Ukraine, and I think it was in 2022.
Yes.
I believe you had an opportunity to learn a few things there about the connections made with Ukraine and our space communication satellites.
So I've made four trips to Ukraine since the war began. And on each of them, I've really tried to explore the technologies, especially from U.S. companies and the U.S. government, that Ukraine is using to be able to stay in a fight with a much bigger, better armed adversary. And so I did write about it in 2022. I was just in Ukraine before the House finally voted to pass the military assistance. And what I've seen on those trips is that Ukraine depends enormously on commercial satellite resources. For example, Ukraine could not communicate with its frontline commanders without Elon Musk's Starlink system. Elon Musk has thousands of satellites in orbit, spinning the globe, beaming down what amounts to Wi-Fi coverage for the world. That's how the Ukrainians communicate with headquarters. It's how they get targeting information in the field. So it's crucial for them. The information that is being sent to those commanders via Starlink also comes from commercial space systems. There are commercial optical imaging satellites that provide what used to be called spy satellite photographs that were only available to NRO, our spy agency, and a few other countries. They provide synthetic aperture radar imagery, again, commercially, that can see through clouds and identify buildings. Thermal imaging that can show missile launches and artillery shots. So there are all these things that Ukraine is getting from a satellite array that the U.S. and the West have, and Russia and China don't have. And it's been a problem for them in the war. And in a sense, it's no surprise that Russia recently has been revealed to be developing offensive weapons that could take out these commercial satellites in low Earth orbit, because it doesn't have anything comparable. And I think clearly the Russians feel that in a real crisis that was heading toward global war, that this would be the only way they could disable these key resources.
When it comes to Musk's Starlink, do I remember correctly that he backed off of using his systems at one point, claiming that it was somehow involving him in a war between Russia and the U.S.?
So Musk resisted Ukrainian efforts to extend their Starlink coverage to Russian-occupied Crimea. This is legally a part of Ukraine, but sure, Russia took it over in 2014 and regards it as now as Russian territory. And Musk thought, and I must admit, there were some senior officials in the Pentagon who agreed that the operations the Ukrainians were contemplating there that would use the broadband imagery from Starlink would be escalatory, might involve the U.S. in difficulty. So Musk pulled back. But the Ukrainians were upset, but he had some support from U.S. defense officials. He got very nervous about his general involvement in the war and said, I'm not getting paid for this. It's, you know, this is a nuisance, and came close to cutting it off. But he was talked back into that. He now has a contract, or Starlink has a contract with the U.S. government to stabilize that relationship. But to be honest, Bob, one of the things that worries me is as more of our national security gets, in effect, becomes a public-private partnership with these extraordinary companies, we're a little bit at the mercy of the private entrepreneurs, quirky people like Elon Musk, who might decide one day, you know, I've got a lot of business in China, I'm making Teslas, I want to sell Teslas to China, I don't want to be in this situation. So they pull the plug on their technology. And if we don't have good alternatives, that gives these private business people enormous leverage. So that's just something for people to think about going forward.
Yeah, and that seems to be a very good reason why you would have a U.S. Space Force. In other words,
Yeah, exactly. That you'd want the government to have its own resources, and you know that the Space Force is doing partnerships with these companies, the so-called Geospatial Intelligence Agency, which does mapping and all kinds of exotic things, now more and more uses commercial satellites rather than the fancy spy satellites that the NRO, National Reconnaissance Office, has. There's no getting away from the fact that public and private are increasingly interwoven, and that is something that somehow has got to be managed by, each administration that comes to power is going to have to figure this out.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is David Ignatius, author of the new thriller, Phantom Orbit. Well, Phantom Orbit is highly informative as a novel. I have an old saying I picked up from Camus that fiction is the lie through which we tell the truth.
And, that's great.
Yeah. And my listeners have heard that more often than they want to, I assume. But it's my effort to get listeners to read fiction as well as nonfiction. Your book is both, and you tell the story through the lives and careers of Edith Ryan and Ivan Volkov. Why don't you just give our listeners a rundown of who these two folks are and again, we don't give anything away here on Reader's Corner, so
let me do this delicately. I should just say, in response to your quote on Camus, a Syrian friend of mine said to me 10 or 15 years ago, David, you only tell the truth in your fiction. just, there you go.
This is a little similar.
Yeah, I'm going to add that to my repertoire.
So the book opens with a Russian astrophysicist named Ivan Volkov. He's not a spy. He's been working for a Russian research institute for decades, who comes to believe that Russia and China have developed what he thinks of as a kill switch that could cripple the GPS system that is the backbone of our cell phones, which, you know, locate themselves via four satellites. They need a four-satellite connection, in effect, to operate. Anytime we get on an airplane, it's GPS navigation that's getting it to its destination. Every time we get in a car, we all know we use Waze or GPS. So the effects of being able to turn that off on our country, on the world, would be enormous. So the Russian says, I have to inform the CIA about this. They need to know. On the CIA website, your listeners can go check it out for themselves. There's an invitation in various languages to people around the world who know things that matter to share that information with the U.S. through the CIA. And that's exactly what Volkov does. He sends a message saying, you know, you can't trust your satellites. Your world is about to be frozen. North is going to turn into South. You're at the mercy of something you don't understand. And tries to explain how people can get in touch with him. And he doesn't hear anything back from the CIA, just silence. And that continues in different ways through the book. I won't explain all that, but that's really part of what the mystery of the story is. So that's Volkov. Volkov, when he's a young man, after that opening in the real time, happening right now, we dial back to when he was a student. He was in the years after the Soviet Union had cracked up. He'd come from this Russia's version of Pittsburgh, big steel town in the middle of the Ural Mountains. He couldn't afford his tuition at Moscow State University, so he'd gone to Beijing, where he could get a scholarship to study astronomy and astroscience. And there he meets a young American graduate student named Edith Ryan, who, unbeknownst to him, has signed up to work for the CIA and is in a year of kind of transition where she's, in effect, a spotter looking for potential assets. She's not a case officer yet, but she's doing a lot of the work of one. She meets Volkov. She sees his interests, how useful he could be, puts him in contact with somebody from the agency. But as happens in life, she begins to develop a deep emotional attachment to him. And she finally realizes that what she's doing, straddling the two, professional and personal, is just wrong. And so she breaks it off suddenly. Volkov doesn't understand, but he suspects he knows what's going on. And this is a burden that she carries as a character really through the whole arc of the novel. The two of them end up together, complicated story, but I hope plausible. But she's carrying that burden of the thing she did wrong when she was a young woman starting out. So those are the two key characters. There's a Chinese character who helps us to see all of the incredible things that China is trying to do in space. But who similarly is kind of off kilter with the people around him. So, you know, those are the characters that drive the novel. I don't have to tell you, you're obviously a reader of fiction. You can have wonderful plot details, but unless the people through whom the story is told are plausible to the reader, you don't really have a novel. And I hope in this case the characters do make that difference.
Well, first of all, you've answered one question I was going to ask you when I read about that website on the CIA's website where you can go in and talk with them about what you know. I didn't realize that existed, but there it is for people to see.
There it is. Well, I try not to make up things like that. It's there for the world to see, but people right. often don't realize it. That these people who use that method of communication are known in the CIA as virtual walk-ins. Once upon a time, somebody would walk in the door of an embassy or consulate and share information, but now they can do it electronically. Shorthand for that is VWs. So somebody will say, we just had a VW from Russia. So that's part of the real world of espionage. Obviously, when you get a message like this, you have to really test whether it's for real or not, whether it's an attempt to deceive you with false information, draw you into a trap. That's a problem with a real defector and a virtual defector alike. Mm-hmm.
And as to the point you make about making sure that the fictional relationship between these two, Volkov and Ryan, is real and plausible, as you say, I'm reading the last line of your book, which says, "You have to help me with this. I have grave doubts about happy endings." Now, that doesn't mean anything to anybody who hasn't read the book yet, but I read it and I thought of these novelists who will do six versions of a story, six novels in a row, one after the other. And I thought, oh, gosh, I wonder if maybe there's going to be a sequel. I was so personally taken with these two characters. But then I thought of David Ignatius as I know him as a novelist, and I thought, no, my guess is he's going to move on.
I'm pleased that you're interested enough in the characters that you'd love to know what happens next. And I have my thoughts about that. I think that's part of the fun of reading a novel is you get to imagine what the sequel might be.
Yeah.
In my case, I've never carried characters from novel to novel. I like to start fresh. It's partly because I am my journalistic background. I get curious. I want to do new things. I want new characters, new settings. I wrote a series of novels in the beginning about the Middle East, which I was covering as a journalist and knew, I sometimes feel I knew too much about. But I began to want to branch out and go different places. So, you know, I enjoy reading. I mean, you know, who doesn't love George Smiley? If John le Carré hadn't written multiple novels about George Smiley, our lives as readers would be diminished. But I just I've never wanted to do that myself.
Mm-hmm. So let's focus for a moment, if we could, on the technology of this novel. The U.S. GPS system compared to Russia's, I think it's called GLONASS. I may be pronouncing it wrong. But I wonder if you could tell us what is the difference, and then maybe you could launch into something about what the Chinese are doing, because there is a still a fairly significant increase in satellites in space that are U.S. as opposed to Chinese, but the question is what's in them?
So just to get to your last point, well, one interesting problem for the Russians and Chinese is that they don't know what's in all these U.S. commercial satellites going up into space. So they're set up for modular components that can be dropped in, and you can, in effect, rent space in a small satellite. And you know, a renter could be anybody. Yeah. So that's a dilemma. The GPS system of ours has a lot of redundancy built into it, that there are sort of extra GPS satellites that are available. There are all sorts of tests. People have thought about some of the dilemmas that I raise and tried to prepare for them. As I said earlier, you need your cell phone needs four GPS points of connection to locate. In the book, I use something from the literature about GPS, like four pieces of string coming down, the one that you're at the exact precise point where the four pieces fit. That's how you locate where the user is. Our system has been developed over many years. It began as a classified system, but as with the internet itself, which began as a way for the Defense Department to communicate among little laboratories, it's exploded, and the U.S. was smart enough to make it available to everybody for commercial use. That's why we have this amazing world of technology that we do. Other countries saw the importance of these satellite communication, satellite navigation systems, global positioning is what the initials stand for, and so began to develop their own. The Russians had a system called GLONASS back in the days when they were a premier space power. The Chinese developed the Beidou system, which is now pretty robust, not as good as GPS, but pretty good. In the book, I explain the people who were the pioneers in that system. They're real people in China's developments. In this technology have been incredibly rapid. Europe has its own GPS system. Japan has one. India has one. But those are all kind of backups. The heart of the world's wiring in space is still basically America's GPS.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a brief reprint of an article that ran in The Atlantic in 2016. It's the beginning of one of the concluding chapters in your book. And the headline reads, "What happens if GPS fails despite massive reliance on the system's clocks? There's still no long-term backup." Now, that was 2016.
Yep.
Is there today?
So there are better backups today. There's more redundancy built into the system now than 2016. For military uses, there's been an attempt to develop entirely different systems, you know, inertial systems of navigation, so you don't have to connect with anything. Because it's with modern jamming, electronic warfare, it's so relatively easy to cut off GPS signals. So the military wants to make sure that its planes in the air don't depend on those links with a commercial system. Same with its precision-guided missiles. So there's been a lot done, but there's still some fundamental vulnerabilities. I don't want to go into any of the details of this, but one odd wrinkle that would undermine all the efforts to build in fail-safes. But, you know, I think what we all know from our world is that these magnificent technologies are vulnerable to failures. I mean, software crashes. Hopefully it's fixed quickly. You know, how many times have you sat trying to get a Netflix show and all you get is a blank screen because there's something? What's the interference? There's a problem in the system, in the server, who knows? But in wartime, the government can't just sit there waiting for the system to boot up. It's got to have alternatives. So they're working on them. But we're still pretty vulnerable. The fancier our technology gets, it's like a car, you know, the more breakdown really is hard to fix.
Today I'm speaking with David Ignatius, author of the new book, Phantom Orbit. The book is a thrilling story of espionage against the backdrop of our nation's renewed interest in space exploration amid geopolitical tumult. At one point in your novel, Edith Ryan asks whether our ground stations are safe from cyber attack. What are our ground stations, and what's the answer to Edith's question?
So I believe that our GPS system has 16 different ground stations. They're located often in odd places, islands in the middle of the Pacific or the Atlantic, to give you the ability to communicate with the satellites in space. But one really interesting thing that intelligence services, certainly our adversaries, I suspect are the U.S. too, have realized is that the ground stations themselves are vulnerable to attack. The one thing I explore in the book is how you'd penetrate the supply chain for communicating with incredibly important satellite systems. And in my book, it's the little things. It's the dishes, the routers, the points of connection, not the big system. You'd never get inside that, but the little things that would allow you to put bugs and flaws in the system. Another thing I don't explore much in the book, I just refer to it in passing, but I think it's a big deal. These ground stations communicate, for the most part, with undersea fiber optic cable systems, which we now know are highly vulnerable to sabotage or collection by other intelligence services. You know, all these services have their special underwater special forces. Well, one of the things they do is tap cables. It's been in the news many times over the decades. So that's a point of vulnerability, and I think it's one that's worried people. You know, if you were heading toward a moment of conflict with China, let's say, maybe they have pre-positioned special forces teams that would have as point of attacks what they know to be the communication connections with these ground stations. You know, if I was sitting in the Beijing Ministry of Defense, that's what I'd be thinking about. So that's the kind of thing the Space Force, all elements of our military, I think, are trying to anticipate because they're vulnerabilities.
Speaking of China, Putin's recent state visit to China raise the question in my mind as to whether or not in their meetings would they discuss the U.S. satellite communications in Ukraine, or in any way have they worked together instead of separately when it comes to how much trouble, you might say, that the Russians could cause for the Ukraine's communication system. What do you think?
That's a great question. It's a big secret to what extent there's a technical liaison and cooperation between the two countries' intelligence services on this most sensitive issue. It's hard to think of anything that would be more sensitive and secret than this. In my book, I hypothesized the Chinese worried about Russia's vulnerability to the U.S. satellite arrays in Ukraine, do help out behind the scenes and you know, are available not just on a rhetorical support level, but actual technical help. But you make me think that's a really good question for me to explore as a journalist. I'd love to know what the answer to that is.
Well, maybe it'll be in your next book. Who knows?
Well, or my next column. It's good. It's a good question.
Yeah, great. There's a moment in the novel when Volkov is very discouraged by the treatment he receives from Americans. And I guess this goes back to the CIA website that invites people to talk. And as you pointed out earlier in our conversation, the CIA has to be very sure these folks are for real and not some setup. I guess the question is, Here's a Russian who's risking his life to help the U.S. and he's treated like a criminal. That's what he says. Is that just for novelistic effect, I guess you could call it? Or
no, that's happened. I mean, I could cite you many instances over time. I'll cite one. There was a Russian defector who came out who claimed to have evidence that the Russians couldn't have been involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. And people now judge him to probably have been accurate in what he reported. But the head of CIA counterintelligence at the time, the legendary James Angleton, decided he was lying and basically locked him up for 2 years, trying to force him to admit that he had been sent deliberately to deceive us. There are other operations where, Russians who appeared to be legitimate agents were in fact deceptive, that caused some terrible wrangles. That's the biggest nightmare, if you can imagine being a CIA officer in Moscow trying to run sources there. You know, you live for somebody to, you know, knock on the door electronically or otherwise, give you information. But once you get it, how can you trust that it's for real? It's not part of an operation designed to set you up.
Yeah.
So, you know, the dilemma that my character Volkov encounters, they don't trust me. That's been, we've blown off many agents from what I've learned in my reporting, many agents over the decades because people didn't trust them.
Well, let's talk about something you alluded to a little bit earlier. We're running out of time here, so I want to make sure I get this one in. Is there a sufficient regulation of oversight of satellites in the U.S., and can there be any form of international coordination, if not regulation? I mean, that, of course, does involve folks like the U.S. and China and Russia coming together. It's not going to happen tomorrow morning. Your thoughts?
So, I mean, there's got to be a system of rules of the road. Space is getting crowded. In low Earth orbit, you have now thousands and thousands of commercial satellites. You have debris, and just knowing what's up there, so things don't, you know, if you run into something at the speeds that that satellites travel, they obviously do enormous damage. So you need to have that kind of international coordination, and that exists. Every time a country launches a satellite, it's filed with the international oversight body. The radio bands that are used by satellites to connect are similarly monitored by the International Telecommunications Organization, more powerful than you might imagine. And ideally, you'd want to have treaties that govern what's permissible in space. We really don't want this to be a kind of all-out zone of conflict where people, you know, use nuclear weapons to blow whole arrays of satellites to smithereens. The problem in this treaty area is, as with any arms control limitation, how on earth would you verify it? How would you be confident that the other side was not putting up
disguised weapons that in a crisis could be turned against you? And the answer is it's almost impossible to verify. So I fear that some kind of balance of terrors, what we describe it as, the nuclear weapons, is going to exist in space, where we know our adversaries can do things that would be very damaging to us. We try to limit through defenses the damage that would be done, and we try to deter by our offenses an adversary from striking us, because we could do the same thing. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling we're heading toward that kind of regime in space, but even so, we need more rules than we have mm-hmm. for everybody's benefit.
I can squeeze in one last question here, David. What's your thoughts on that disclosure from the chair of the House Intelligence Committee that Russia is working on a nuclear device that could be exploded in space? I think you've commented on this, and maybe it's not quite the warning that some think.
So Mike Turner, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, demanded that the White House brief the Congress on what he had been told as chairman of the committee the Russians were doing. Essentially, the Russians see this enormous commercial array in space and the dangers it poses, and they have been trying to think, what can we do about it? And they came up with one primitive answer, which is detonate a nuclear weapon in space and blow everything in low Earth orbit up. You know, create a debris field. So it's basically a no-go zone, and we won't be able to operate there, our companies, but neither will the Russians, neither will the Chinese. It's a terrible idea from everybody's standpoint. It's really just primitive and barbaric, it's like poisoning the rivers to try to choke off your enemy. But what are you going to drink from? I think they're going to be much more sophisticated Russian and Chinese systems in the future. What you'd want to do is prevent satellites from communicating with each other and with the Earth. And there are ways that are emerging to do that, to get into the communications nodes, to shut them down, to use this kind of malware that can affect our systems on Earth. You can do that in space. And there are a lot of smart people thinking about ways you'd inject right. malware from a distance. So, the Russians are in this game. The Chinese are too. We have a U.S. Space Force that's got to be thinking about these same issues. Pretty much everything that I write about in Phantom Orbit, I think, is happening in real life, and it's accelerating, because it's like any weapons race. The more you have, the more you want.
And that's the reason to get out and get a copy of Phantom Orbit, a thriller by David Ignatius. David, thanks so much for writing this, and thanks so much for giving us the time here on Reader's Corner.
It was great to talk with you and your listeners. Thanks for having me.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
New from The Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.